Call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order. It's the 24th of February. We have an ambitious agenda. We're going to switch the order because of the schedules of our colleagues and take on the House Bill 2720. So I'll open a public hearing on that. And while we're hearing a brief summary from Barbara, I invite our legislative colleagues to come forward, please. Representative Berger, Senator Moore, Senator Johnson, all here. We're going to go in sequence. I was hoping we could all have everybody together, but however you guys want to do it. Barbara.
HB 2720 allocates monies from the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund to the Oregon Innovation Council for deposit in the Oregon Innovation Fund. Delineates specific organizations in the amounts that are to be allocated for the Oregon Innovation Fund. Limits the biennial expenditures of lottery funds allocated to the Council of the Oregon Innovation Fund. Declares an emergency effective July 1, 2009.
Thank you. Representative Berger, start us off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. I ask your indulgence to get me up here early, and I'm in very exalted company. My message for you is a simple one. When I heard about Oregon Inc. as a concept legislatively when we were in the middle of the last bad times, I said, this looks like the kind of effort that I want to be involved with, something that's forward-thinking, something that combines the best elements of Oregon to move us forward, and got my way onto the council, and I believe that when I leave this building and go back to being a real person instead of a legislator, I'm going to point to Oregon Inc. as being one of the things that I am most proud of that I did for Oregon, and yet, in the end, I'm not the one that did it. It's these other folks that actually did it. Oregon Inc. Represents more than 40 statewide leaders from industry, higher ed, government, and they have identified a roadmap that has sort of become the portfolio of Oregon Inc. And that roadmap is currently helping Oregon create and retain high-quality jobs. And it is a national model in areas such as nanotechnology, green building, sustainable practices, and manufacturing. This is cutting-edge stuff. Because of Oregon Inc., we are positioned well to move forward. We are way ahead of other states in saying, what's right over the horizon that's going to help our state? Where can we be best positioned? And that's what Oregon Inc. is about. I'm proud of it. I hope that you folks who haven't had a vetting in it understand how far ahead we are, and it is because of private sector, university, the smart people in Oregon who care about Oregon coming forward. So thank you for your indulgence. Have fun, and I won't go into all of the details of it because there's plenty of smart people behind me who can do that.
Thank you, Representative Berger. And just as a bit more of introduction for the committee, we have a long list of experts who will be here. And I know you have a number of other obligations, so please
be on your way.
Thanks for being here. We'll hear a little more introductory comments from these two experts, and we'll hold our questions for the end. A lot of what you might be asking initially, I suspect, will be covered by the folks as they present. So, Wally, David, please.
Chair Reed, committee members, for the record, my name is Wally Van Valkenburg. I am the chair of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. To my right is Dave Chen, who is the chair of the Oregon Innovation Council. I sit on the Innovation Council ex officio by virtue of my position on the Economic Community Development Commission. I also have a day job where I'm a lawyer in Portland, and wanted to say that for the record. I see a note to summarize testimony. I have submitted some prepared testimony, but I will be brief and let Mr. Chen carry the lion's share of the load on the introductory comments here. I guess I'd like to emphasize three things that I've tried to address in my prepared testimony about the importance of the Oregon Innovation Plan and the Oregon Innovation Council, the council which you, the legislature, created in 2005. The first is that in terms of the overall economic development effort in Oregon, the Innovation Plan and Council represent a key part of our efforts to bring the private sector into work as a partner with the state and with higher ed in job creation. It's been a tremendously successful venture in terms of engaging the business community more actively, significantly more so than was the case when I first joined the Economic Development Commission in 2003. The second point I'd like to make is that the innovation plan has been a catalyst for unprecedented, in my view, collaboration among our universities. One of the things that we've heard time and time again from outside experts who come and look at what we do from an economic development standpoint is that we have some great things going, but one of the things that we miss compared to some of our competitors is the presence of a significant research institution, a significant research university in the state. We're able to compensate, I think, for the lack of that kind of big dog institution by the collaboration we've seen among Oregon State University, University of Oregon, OHSU, OIT, Portland State University. All of those universities have participated in the innovation plan, and together they have created a collaboration that's enabled us to fight above our weight with other states in terms of attracting grants and in terms of the kind of job creation that can come out of innovation. The final point I'd like to make is that this isn't just about the innovation plan and the Innovation Council, although that's what we're here to talk about today. The seeds that the Innovation Council have sown have infiltrated all of what we do at the Economic and Community Development Department now. We are much more focused than we were, again, 6 years ago when I joined the commission on competitively differentiating ourselves from other states. So we're trying to focus on industries where we have a competitive advantage over other states. The innovation plan has helped us to do that. I'd like to just conclude by saying something that I've commented on privately to some of you, which is that in these difficult times, I think it's important to recognize what you're investing in here as a revenue generator rather than just a revenue taker. Although the jobs that that will result from the investment that you would be making this biennium may not materialize until a subsequent biennium, it's critical for us to be able to continue this kind of effort if we want to have the kind of economy that can generate the tax revenue that supports education, social services, public safety, and all the other things that I know you're struggling to fund. So with that, thank you for your time, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Chen.
Thank you very much. Please, David.
For the record, my name is David Chen. I am with Equilibrium Capital Group and also the chair of the Oregon Innovation Council. Chair Reed and the committee, members of the committee, thank you again for letting me address you today on behalf of House Bill 2720. What I'm hoping to do today is give you a brief overview of the results of the 2007 Innovation Plan and a preview of the 2009 Innovation Plan. As a brief reminder, the Innovation Council is chartered with a set of tasks and responsibilities. First and foremost is to develop a plan each biennium that comprises of the initiatives that the council, through its work, believes will have the greatest impact on driving innovation-based economic development, which is really translates into jobs, the retention and the growth of businesses within our economy. What initiatives have the greatest opportunity to grow the greatest number of family wage jobs and companies within our community? The process that we use is a bottoms-up process where we effectively go out and look for and ask initiatives and collaborations to come forward with the best ideas, with the highest return on investments. Those ideas are vetted by the subcommittees of the council and then funneled up then ultimately into a biennial plan. Reflecting on where we are today, I'd be remiss if I did not acknowledge that our country and our state is in a dire situation. I I think we certainly feel the amount of challenge that is going on in this building as you work through the $3 billion of shortfall that you're looking at within this coming biennium. And this is by no means different from the same level of, frankly, pain and task and challenge that's being faced in state house after state house and in our federal government. But if I were to look and maybe put on my CEO hat, if a CEO is faced with this kind of situation wherein we're faced with this kind of economic downturn and challenge, the first thing that you do is you do need to respond to the realities of the market and cut and reduce and take everything down to the bare bones that's possible. But equally important is the need that in the direst of circumstances, we know that the economy will turn around, and when it turns around, we want to be positioned for growth. We know that given the priorities that you have in front of you, that you have to spend 90% of your time and attention towards paring back and making sure that we can fit within the means that we have. But I would urge you to spend 10% of that time and 10% thinking about how we grow out of this economy. Joe Courtwright gave some testimony last week, and I'll just quote a little bit of, or paraphrase a little bit of what he said. This issue of recovery is a bit of a misnomer because the term implies that we will return to our previous state, when in fact most economists believe that the economy will emerge from this recession looking fundamentally different. Many of these 100,000 jobs that are lost won't come back, but new jobs will be created, particularly in renewable energy and energy efficiency, and I would just paraphrase, in new innovative industries and new innovative approaches. And that, in essence, is the heart of the Oregon Innovation Council task, and that, in effect, is really the what's embodied in the Innovation Council plan that you have in front of you. The second key point that I'd like to make is that whether it was by great foresight or by great luck, one of the things that you'll read within the line items of the Oregon Innovation Plan is that they align almost directly with the agenda that is being put forward by our federal government. If you look at the federal stimulus plan, the emphasis that it has on renewable energy, on energy efficiency, even the healthcare portions of the federal stimulus plan align towards things like infectious diseases. And again, if you look at where the foresight for this original biennial plan, the Oregon Innovation Biennial Plan, and this current plan, and look at the line items, in many ways, these line items align very, very closely with the federal agenda. I'll remind you that first and foremost, BEST, which is our opportunity to show our leadership in the built environment and renewable energy as a signature research center, absolutely aligns with some of the top uppermost priorities of the federal stimulus, of the federal funding, and the federal agenda. The food initiative, if you look at the output of the food initiative that is built in the Oregon Innovation Plan, a very, very significant portion of the food initiative was how do we help the processed food industry in Oregon become more innovative by, in effect, becoming more energy efficient, more cost competitive, and therefore more competitive on a global basis. And again, aligning with the emphasis in our nation's stimulus around energy efficiency. The WAVE initiative absolutely aligns with our agenda in terms of renewable energy. Even ONAMI, our other signature research center, aligns very much along the lines of DOE and DOD's energy initiatives. And OTRADI, our play within infectious diseases. Again, a deep alignment of the Innovation Council. I think that's increasingly significant because part of the Innovation Council strategy is, in fact, to use the state funding as catalyst and stimulus for our ability to actually garner federal funding. And that's a strategy that has continued to be played out in its 4 years. All this may, in fact, ring hollow unless there is, in fact, results. And I'd like to remind you of some of the results that the Innovation Council, in its 2007 plan, has already garnered. Within ONAMI, year-to-date, since its inception, ONAMI has brought in $77 million of federal funding that in all likelihood would not have been there if we had not stood up the Signature Research Center. Equally important are two newest Signature Research Centers, which in effect have only been stood up and in operation for less than a year, are also producing results. Otrati, within the last 6 months, has brought in $18 million of federal funding that did not exist prior. Best, over the course of the last 3 months, 6 months, I'm sorry, has brought in $3.5 million of federal funding towards those applied areas of the built environment, the green building, as well as in the renewable energy area. So I think that this investment that you made in the 2007 biennium, in fact, has started to pay out and is paying out with hard dollars, hard jobs, and with the results that it's producing. I'd urge you that as you consider, again, in this very, very difficult time, that as we have to pare back, that I'd urge you to consider the 2009 plan that we've submitted as a sound investment, not only in terms of the current results that it pays, but in terms of the future results that it potentially paves the way for in terms of a future economy for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope you can stick around. We may have questions for you as we proceed. And with that, Senator Morse, Senator Johnson, if you are available, and Ms. Hamilton, please come forward.
Come up with a troika.
That sounds great.
You want to go first? Go first. We're the third-party validators.
Good afternoon. My name is Nancy Hamilton. I'm the governor's senior policy advisor for economic development. And thank you, Chair Reed, and members of the committee to hear more about the important work that Oregon Inc. is doing. And as Dave Chen and Wally Van Valkenburg have already said very eloquently, the work that happens with Oregon Inc. is critical. It's a relatively inexpensive investment for enormous returns, not just in the short term, but in the long term. And I just wanted to speak very briefly, and I know I'm going to be speaking to the committee again regarding the reorganization efforts at the Office of Economic and Community Development, but I wanted to just take a moment today to discuss the questions that often come up regarding the relationship between Oregon Inc. and OECD's business efforts. And I think perhaps the most useful analogy is in Germany 20 years ago when they looked at building their core industry sector around solar. A lot of folks said, what are you doing that for? Who in the world is going to use solar? And why would Germany lead? And some folks that were the equivalent of our Oregon Inc. members said, we think there's an opportunity here down the road and we need to stick with it and grow it. And of course, Germany is now one of the centers internationally for solar manufacturing. Oregon is now becoming the center for North American solar manufacturing, and that's because of our relationship not just with Germany, but with our relationship among our national partners saying this is where this kind of thing grows. And I bring this example up because I see WAVE as what solar was in Germany 20 years ago, and you see it as a major sector opportunity in Germany. It helps fuel their entire national economy, and WAVE in Oregon can create for us an equal opportunity perhaps in 10, 15, 20 years. But if we don't do the work that's being done very importantly right now, we won't be able to get those kinds of rewards in the out years. And I would also just like to echo one of the comments Dave Chen made, which especially now that I'm very involved with the federal stimulus package and speaking with our counterparts in D.C., the need to have a state-based participation, financial participation to access many of the competitive dollars at the federal level is going to be critical. States and entities, municipal districts, et cetera, that aren't prepared to partner financially in those entities, they're going to be out of the game. And our partnerships with Oregon Inc. that they created are our infrastructure for that partnership. And I see our ability to leverage significantly more dollars than the very impressive numbers that Dave Chen just offered to you. So, and finally, I think the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department has done, under Director McCabe and Chair Van Valkenburg's leadership, a great deal to coordinate what happens at Oregon Inc. and translate it into short-term job opportunities as well as long-term economic investments. And I believe you will be seeing quite a lot more of that over the next 12 to 18 months. And so I wanted to state that formally for the group, and I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you very much, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing the 16th Senate District. I also serve ex officio at the pleasure of President Courtney on the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. And in that capacity, I sit on the Audit and Accountability Committee for Oregon Inc. A couple of things. Given the realities of the budget, I just want to state that I think we're all knowledgeable of how difficult that is going to be. But if we need to look at a place that I think is paying direct returns, just as Ms. Hamilton and Mr. Chen and Mr. Van Valkenburg have already laid out, it's Oregon Inc. The governor has made it very clear his support for this initiative. It was included in his budget. And I think that even though his first priority is to safeguard the basic needs of Oregonians, that he believes, as many of us do, that we need to continue to make these critical investments in innovative projects and programs that both retain jobs and position Oregon as a leader in sustainable green industries once we come out of this economic depression that we're in. My main message to bring to you today is that I think the public-private collaboration represented by Oregon Inc. is really extraordinary. We talk a lot about public-private partnerships. This is the embodiment of it. I have been in meetings where there are sometimes upwards of 40 folks, all of whom have sacrificed revenue time in their own offices to come together to bring sharp minds and real enthusiasm for positioning Oregon in a leadership role in lots of these initiative areas. It is a true public-private partnership, and these folks are bringing their talent and time to this initiative for no other remuneration than the expectation that they will have helped position Oregon favorably to take advantage of the rewards that will come out of these initiatives. Oregon Inc. is taking its share of cuts at 3 o'clock this afternoon. I will go in and, along with your colleague, Representative Edwards, preside over a committee that is looking at the cuts that are being visited on the Oregon Inc. agenda. I think our obligation in the next session, in the next biennium, once we conclude 07-09, is to figure out how we can preserve as much of the funding around these important initiatives as possible, because I firmly believe, and that's why I came down today to testify in front of you, that this is the positioning for Oregon for the next wave of jobs that are going to be created out of Oregon's creative class, out of Oregon's good thinking about these kinds of initiatives, and frankly, our positioning to be in a leadership role as we move forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. For the record, Frank Morse, I represent the State Senate in District 8, which is the Albany-Corvallis area. My message today is an encouragement to the Assembly to stay grounded. And what I mean by that is to keep our focus on the horizon and have a vision that we emerge from this session. We're literally in the age, the period of the unthinkable once again. We, in fiscal year 2002, end June 30th, we had $2.4 billion that just evaporated, in excess of 20% of the expected general fund revenue. And we were informed Friday by our state economist that we had, from the December forecast to this forecast, 11.7% reduction in a four-month period in expected revenues for the 09-11 session. We are, again, in the age of the unthinkable. But what I would ask us to think about is, what did we do in response to that in the 03 session? We had a vision, and the vision was to create that signature research center called ONAMI. And we found a way to fund it. And we've seen what the benefits have been from that. It has produced outstanding benefits. And as we as legislators have been pretty much on the sideline, but watching the work of what was then OCED and now Oregon Inc., watching the work, the dedication, the literally thousands of hours that have gone in by people that don't collect a dime, but they have a passion for Oregon. And that passion is to build jobs in an innovation economy. And so my encouragement is that we keep our eyes on the horizon with a goal, and that goal is job creation through this innovation economy and build our economy and find a way, and my admonishment to my good colleague here is that we find a way to sustain this effort and not let it fall. So would encourage you to endorse this measure and pass it down to Ways and Means, and hopefully we'll emerge with truly a vision for Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues.
Thank you, Senator Morse. I suspect the senators have busy schedules like us, so they may need to leave quickly. Do we have any quick questions for the senators while they're here? Thank you, Ms. Gapes. Done a good job introducing us. Thanks
Mr.
very much.
Chair, before they leave,
Representative Holby.
I might have a question for Nancy Hamilton.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe the senators can answer it too. I don't know. You know, just from the economic development world, I suppose, you know, we're looking at these federal stimulus monies coming into our state. Do you know of any place else where our state could invest money to generate a better return than Oregon Inc.?
Thank you, senators.
No.
Thank you.
No is the big answer.
I'll actually go one step further, and I think that thanks for throwing what I think is a softball here. I really do think that you need to consider the Oregon Innovation Council plan, both at the tactical level, which is that the numbers and the jobs that I've talked about, but at this moment in time in our country, I actually think that it's actually of strategic value to the state. And as Nancy has said, as the stimulus rolls out of Washington, the agencies and the administration are going to be looking for examples of leadership across this country that are the recipients of these stimulus dollars. And I will tell you that I had the rare privilege of about 3 weeks ago of sitting in Carol Browner's office in the White House, reviewing and previewing the Oregon Way plan and de facto parts of the Innovation Council, and I will tell you that their perspective on this is that what we are doing, as Nancy has said, in this community is unique in the United States, and I think this is our time to actually take our opportunities within sustainability that we're acknowledged as having the leadership in, and really being able to use it on a national level to, in fact, garner unfair share of these stimulus opportunities and the national agenda as it regards sustainability and many of the great core strength areas of this state, but that are also built into this plan.
And if I could offer a footnote to Dave's comments, I would add simply that as we look to recruit companies to Oregon or keep companies in Oregon or grow companies that are here, there are a few things that are core to their desire to either stay here or come here or grow here. And one of those is our workforce capacity. And one of those is our institutional capacity. And one of those is the peer group that they will be joining or keeping within. And the more we grow our capacity in these core areas where we have competitive advantage, the greater our opportunity becomes. We amortize that much more quickly the more we do it. And we have beaten states who have deeper pockets and bigger opportunities because in this day and age, and I certainly hear this with the Obama administration, the best answer one can have is our ability to be creative and to be fast, not to necessarily be big. And we have that in spades over our competitors in those industries where there is a real growth opportunity in the next century. And so I welcome the question. I hope that helps answer. So, and Oregon Inc. is key to that.
Thank you. Let's keep moving down our agenda. We'll get into some more detail, some of the initiatives. So I'll invite Skip Rung and Dennis Wild up. And looks like they have some props, perhaps, too. Whichever of you would like to go first, please go ahead.
Okay, I guess I'll go. All right.
Skip's got the toys.
Okay. Well, Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Skip Rung. I'm the President and Executive Director of Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the future of ONAMI, Oregon's nationally known nano initiative, whose success is due to the trust that the legislature and the governor have placed in us. In 2007, the legislature invested $9 million in Onami with the goals of, first, leveraging this money to increase the private and federal dollars flowing into the state for research, and second, providing gap funding to our most innovative startups to help them flourish and become companies that will lead Oregon into the future. In return for that $9 million investment, we have leveraged $79 million in federal and private and philanthropic funding. After six quarters of eight in the biennium to date, we're at $46.8 million in research funding and $32.5 million in private donations, with much thanks for the latter due to Hewlett-Packard, Lori Loquet, and the FEI company. The $79 million, of course, greatly exceeds our goal for the biennium of $40 million, so that's going really well. So our second big goal is creating great companies, and so far there are 15 companies that are part of our Gap Fund program, and the success of them is really where our hopes reside. I would say that as of this moment, eight of them, with many too soon to tell, are great prospects for success, and so I wanted to spend most of the time just sharing a couple of examples. So we'll start with this. We're working with a company called Home Dialysis Plus, building a home kidney machine. This is an inline sterilizer that will allow people to just plug this into the tap water instead of having big tanks of deionized water. First prototype came this week. This is the blood filter that goes with it, you know, a lab prototype. Together, they present an advantage that nobody else has. We're taking the heat exchanger and we're building a custom version, something like this, for Apex Drive Laboratories, which is currently, like HD Plus, raising money in New York, and that's going to enable higher performance of an electric motor that's ideally suited for both electric vehicles and wind generation operated in reverse. Well, the next one is a pair of socks with a nano silver antimicrobial coating. You've probably heard of this sort of thing before, but I don't think you've heard of one that can stand up to 30 hot water washings. Most of these things, and we've got the data, will wash off at about four cold rinses. Not good enough, and it ends up in the environment. This will be really revolutionary for things like hospital scrubs and linens. This company is Dune Sciences, kind of the flagship company of our green nanoscience program. They also, by the way, sell electron microscopy aids to the National Institute of Standards and Technology and other companies. The biggest one, and kind of the funnest one in some ways, is from a company called Impria. You've heard of the transparent transistor technology. These are transparent circuits. Well, what can you do with things like that? Well, with these films, with an Asian partner, they have built working flat panel displays using solution process films. In other words, they didn't require expensive vapor deposition equipment. Saves a lot of money, lots of applications, including solar cells and building materials. Then the last one, also in renewable energy, is a microreactor-assisted nanomaterials deposition, MAND, that's a mouthful, coating technique that applies a anti-reflective coating. In other words, the solar light doesn't come back, it stays where you want it. That's why it's dark here and it's shiny on the rest of the silicon. That, again, is solution processed inexpensively so that you save money to get that anti-reflective coating that you need. Well, our fundamental success strategy in Onami is building powerful collaborative teams from our universities, the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, and industry partners. This is a growing success and a culture shift that should pay dividends for years after we are gone. I love this email from one of our signature researchers, John Connolly, who said, "These Onami projects are really helping to interweave and strengthen the Oregon research community, and I think the payoffs are going to last for a long time." Last October, an independent audit was done of Onami's progress so far, and it shows that our model is working. The report concluded that if we stay on track, Onami-supported companies could produce 608 jobs in the next 2 years and as many as 2,000 by 2011. The breakthroughs Onami is helping create is part of an interrelated portfolio of innovative Oregon programs, which means that some of these technologies, like some I showed you, will one day be part of the work that Oregon Best is promoting with its green and sustainable building practices and technologies. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Reed and committee members. My name is Dennis Wild. I'm a principal at Girding Edelin Development in Portland, Oregon, and I am the chair of the board of Oregon Built Environment and Sustainable Technologies, better known as Oregon Best. Also in attendance today is David Kenney, who's the president and executive director of Oregon Best. I think what's important for you to understand is that even though Oregon Best is just a little less than a year old, it's already had some significant success in terms of, as Skip mentioned, forming this deep collaboration amongst the universities. And this has been mentioned several times, but I think it's really important to appreciate the power of the collaboration of University of Oregon, Oregon State, OIT, PSU, all working collaboratively on the same research project. You bring the best and the brightest of these universities to a level where we can compete with MIT or Cal Berkeley or any other major research university. And that's the only way that we can achieve those kinds of results. And we've had some amazing results to date in terms of work that's being done on solar energy, working with the likes of Solar World, which is recently located in Hillsboro. They're working with some of the labs, which, by the way, are the same labs that Onami helped fund. So we're already getting collaboration and cross fertilization between Onami and Oregon Best. And I think this can go even further. Imagine the glass in those windows, not just being vision glass so you can see out, but generating energy for the building at the same time and still being fully transparent and using low-cost solution-deposited films that Skip was just talking about. Those are the kinds of things that are possible that could be developed here in Oregon and producing Oregon-based jobs. So I think the power of that is that we can then leverage the few dollars that the legislature and the governor award to the signature research centers. We can leverage those into significant payoffs, not just in the distant future, but in the very near future. And so it's that whole idea that we can create jobs now and that we can take advantage of our position, just not just in the United States, but literally in the world in terms of the green building movement. You know, we are recognized across the planet as the home ground for green building technologies and for the deep intellectual property that resides here with our engineers, our architects, and the companies that are practicing these strategies. So I would encourage you to continue to fund Oregon Best and Onami and Otrati and the rest of the signature research centers, because this is the leverage that we will need coming out of this of these economic times. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I think what I'd like to do is ask if there are any questions, just a couple of quick ones, while we have Onami and Best at the table, and then I can invite Bob Lanier and we could take on some discussion on Otrati. So any questions about Onami and Best? Appears you've done a good job with an introduction. Thank you both very much. So let me ask Bob Lanier to join Dr. Beckman at the table and to hear a bit about Otrati, please. Thank you both, and thanks especially for the props. It's very helpful to see some of the tangible evidence of your work. Dr. Beckman.
Excuse me. Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you. For the record, my name is Patricia Beckman, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Translational Research and Drug Development Institute, or Otrati. I joined Otrati about 4 months ago. Obviously, the institute's been in existence for about a year now, but I only joined 4 months ago, and I've come from Seattle. I worked at Immunex and Amgen for the most of my career with a PhD in biochemistry and pharmacology there, working on developing a number of drugs at Immunex, and actually was responsible for the drug that was responsible for Amgen acquiring Immunex and sort of selling out the Seattle area to a certain degree down to the L.A. area. So I understand the principle that you are trying to keep biotech local. And we do have a bioscience strong community here, which I'm sure Bob will tell you about in just a minute. But I came down here because I see this as an opportunity. We are focusing on infectious disease right now. There, we have worked with a couple of different companies as well as all of the universities to look at their technology, to help push their technology into a development framework in order to push it to create jobs in this
in this state. One company in particular that we've worked with is Design Medics, and if you take public testimony later this afternoon, the CEO of Design Medics, Lynn Stevenson, is here to talk to you about that relationship. Essentially, we screened an entire library of chemicals or potential drugs that they had, which they were developing for malaria. And we found 50 different drugs against malaria that had functional activity against malaria. Aside from that, we also found in that library that there were a number of other drugs that worked on E. coli, which causes food poisoning, and other drugs that work on Staph A bacteria, which can be responsible for the infections in hospital patients. So we are working with that company to further develop some of their additional technologies. We are writing grants like mad with both university faculty as well as companies. As Mr. Chen had said prior to my testimony, we've written nearly $20 million worth of grants to date. And I've only been here for 4 months, and $16 million of those grants have been written since I arrived with our collaborators. We have 70 university collaborators that work with us. What I find is particularly exciting is that a New York Times article last week indicated that for each $250,000 of grant that is funded, about 6 to 7 jobs come out of that. Now, that's not necessarily all jobs in the bioscience sector, but 2 or 3 jobs in the bioscience sector of $50,000 to maybe $80,000 would come out of those. The rest would be the support jobs to help keep our companies moving. What I would like to leave you with is that I have about a company, one startup company a week coming into my offices asking to work with us. In some cases, it might end up being a small project that we would do for them. In other cases, it might be, I believe you were given some photographs of our operation. I have 5 people working for me. You made an investment in $2 million worth of equipment in my laboratories. One of the things that we also do is to screen compounds, as we did for Design Medics. It used to be you would screen a compound on a petri dish like that. Now we screen compounds with 384 compounds on a plate, which goes into this machine, this robot, to be able to screen it. We can do things that nobody else has been able to do. We can help the universities and the companies move things fast through the development phase to figure, or through the research phase to define what should be developed. So what I would like to leave you with is that we are right at the nexus of pushing things forward in the bioscience arena to develop more companies and keep them here. I watched a company move to California. I was hoping that it would stay here. And I think that we can do that with the opportunities that you have now allowed us to begin to develop.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Reed, and members of the committee. My name is Bob Lanier. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Bioscience Aid Association. We have 170 members in our association and about 400 other firms that need to join but haven't joined yet. The message that I have about Trotty and our industry is that there are parts of industry that are actually growing this year. We have companies like Biotronic that's expecting to grow and add 100 jobs in 2009. So there are segments of our industry that are actually very strong this year. Life sciences research, which is part of our industry, is half a billion a year in Oregon. We expect that to grow a whole bunch this year and beyond. And, of course, it creates great jobs, high-paying jobs. We keep the talent in Oregon. In our view of Otrati, we're seeing Otrati with the grants that what Otrati is involved with right now as creating at least 40 new high-paying jobs each year. And so I just wanted to leave that thought with you, that this industry is actually, in parts of the industry, is growing in 2009. Help us to take advantage of that growth and take advantage of the NIH funding that's actually being increased this year. The stimulus package has $10 billion more for NIH alone. And that money, we can tap into that money if we have an institution like Trotty that we can work with and help get those funds. So that's my message.
Thank you very much. Are there any quick questions for Otrati? Representative Thatcher.
You mentioned earlier, Patricia, that several companies come and talk to you about partnering with you. Do you
just because they come and talk to you, are you able to work with all of them, or how do you choose who you
work with? We're going to have to start making a priority list at this point of who we will work with. We have, one of the things that I actually didn't mention is upon my walking in, I understood that we were going to have a potential budget cut in what was proposed for our budget when I started. So I've developed a fee-for-service organization going forward where we will be able to charge them for our services. But I will not be hiring any more people until I have those contracts in place so that I can do the work for them. But we will nonetheless still have to prioritize what work we do.
Okay.
We also anticipate putting an endowment in place so that there are various ways that we could work with them, whether it's a direct fee for service or some kind of revenue sharing with the companies.
Okay, thanks. I was just wondering about what the priorities might be, but I guess you're yet to develop what those
The infectious disease market is, since it's a $38 billion market, that's certainly our top priority, but certainly larger contracts with a company as well that would utilize the capacity that we actually have. In some cases, I'm also mentoring some smaller companies to help them do some strategic planning, because I've worked as a venture capitalist in my past, so I'm helping them do strategic planning and find some introductions to the right VCs that can help them. So the kinds of things that I'm doing are very diverse because of my background.
Representative Galizio.
Thank you. You mentioned NIH. I mean, it is nice that at the federal level we have an administration now that actually supports science and values science, which is a good thing and is a change. But are either of you familiar with the proposed life sciences complex down at the waterfront?
Yes, absolutely.
Could you maybe talk a little bit about that and what that might mean?
Bringing together the various researchers of different with different backgrounds, so that they can cross-pollinate and fertilize these ideas, is an absolutely outstanding opportunity. I spent time working in the Accelerator in Seattle, which is a venture-backed incubator. I believe that there is a similar type of an opportunity that is planned within the life science complex to commercialize opportunities. Those kinds of things are absolutely essential for taking the next step to make sure things move forward in a more rapid fashion.
And Trotty is actually planned in that in the life sciences collaborative. I know that the group that's planning it actually had them as the first outside group that would be involved in the life sciences collaborative. So it's their role would be key to what goes on there.
Thanks. Are there other questions? Thank you very much for
Thank you,
Chairman.
Next on our list, Chandra Brown, Clark Nelson, and Jay Bornstein. I hope I'm not mispronouncing that. Moving now from signature research centers to some of the more industry-specific efforts. And whomever would like to start, please go ahead.
Start.
Sure.
Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Clark Nelson, and I'm the manager of human resources for Kraft Foods in Portland. I'm honored to share with you the success story of the Northwest Food Processors Innovation Productivity Center. Funded by Oregon Inc., the Innovation Productivity Center's mission is to help shape the future of the food industry by ensuring its regional competitiveness, growth, and sustainability through enhancing productivity, training industry leaders, and enabling innovation. Through enhancing productivity, the Innovation Productivity Center is seeking measurable results in the areas of job creation and retention and savings to companies, which directly and indirectly sustains the food industry. Projects have occurred or are underway at 16 Oregon food manufacturing plants. Current job retention and the creation is projected at 312 jobs. For instance, through evaluating the productivity and increasing the efficiency of the food processing line, current Innovation Productivity Center projects enabled one Oregon company to retain 135 distressed jobs and a second company to hire 70 new employees, most of whom have disabilities. When hired, it is estimated that half of these individuals will be taken off of state assistance with a total savings of $455,000. The Innovation Productivity Center has connected with this company, with a second company, to create a joint venture. This venture will potentially create 35 new jobs in the first quarter of 2009. In the area of training, the Innovation Productivity Center has developed a program for changing the culture of food processing in Oregon. Through the Sustainable Competitive Innovation System, which is a program that includes executive discussion groups, incumbent worker development workshops, and academic curriculum. For example, in some food processing plants, executive training is leading to the creation of new occupations that are continuing the skills learned from the Sustainable Competitive Innovation System. We personally have utilized folks from the center to train supervisors on new lean manufacturing techniques at our facility that has been very beneficial to our operation. The Innovation Productivity Center has organized 5 sessions. 59 people have attended, including 22 food processing companies and additional partners. On March 5th, the Innovation Productivity Center is conducting 2 innovation courses at Lynn Benton Community College as a part of the rapidly expanding mechatronic and food processing management training. We also have some show and tell, although it might not be as fancy as some of the others we've seen today. This is an Energy Star. Make sure I get this. This is an Energy Star conservation portable submeter, and it measures any electrical energy powered component of the food processing line. This equipment is one example of many that are used as part of our GEMS program, or Green Energy Management System. The Innovation Productivity Center is using this equipment to measure the baseline energy use of the different components of a processing line. The information provides insight into areas where the food processing line can be updated, improved, or recalibrated to provide the best possible performance of the equipment and reduce energy usage. Enhancing the GEMS program to the next level to increase our regional competitiveness and sustainability, the Innovation Productivity Center partnered with the U.S. Department of Energy, Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, and Utilities to conduct a 2-day Energy Vision Workshop, a top energy visioning implementation roadmap meeting in a Northwest Industrial Energy Efficiency Summit. The result? The Northwest Food Processors Association established a goal to reduce energy intensity. The Innovation Productivity Center will lead the implementation of the goal to reduce energy intensity as the industry sector by 25% in 10 years and 50% in 20 years through innovation and technology. The innovation and technology used to meet the energy intensity goal would give the food industry the capacity to create new jobs, create new products, pay state corporate taxes on the increased profit, all of which benefit to the Oregon economy. The goal to reduce energy intensity will exceed 100% state investment in the Innovation Productivity Center over time. On the cutting edge of innovation is a technology transfer initiative with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. The Innovation Productivity Center is working with the National Lab to develop a rapid detection test for Listeria monocytogenes, one of the many pathogenic bacteria that is commonly classified as food poisoning. Salmonella is another. The discovery of a rapid test would change the detection rate from days to hours, resulting in reducing frequency of food poisoning, significantly changing the manner in which food is manufactured worldwide. As you can see, in the Innovation Productivity Center is delivering real results for the Oregon food processing industry and changing the culture of food processing. Through diverse training, productivity, technology transfer, and innovation, the Innovation Productivity Center is not only working, it is bringing innovation and growth to the industry. I personally left Oregon in the late 70s and early 80s because the economy was bad at that time. I grew up here, actually here in Salem. I left, went to Southern California to find work, and was fortunate enough to come back. Without continuing the funding, the work and leadership of this Innovation Productivity Center, we lost, and food processing in Oregon will not continue to grow and prosper. So I ask that you support the funding of the Oregon Inc. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, sir. Let's keep the conversation going, please.
Okay. Chairman Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Meyer J. Bornstein. I'm president and owner of Bornstein Seafoods. I'm second generation, and I'm transitioning my third generation, and we have great confidence in the sustainability of the Oregon resources. We need to retain and create more jobs in the Oregon fishing industry. As the industry moves into the 21st century, there are so many opportunities to promote the sustainable fisheries on which our coastal communities depend. The Community Seafood Initiative is taking a hard look at where those values can be found. Our collaborative efforts are proving successful in terms of advancing the tools that the fishing industry needs to stay viable and to flourish. In the short term, the initiative's ability to make our industry more competitive by making it more efficient is paying off by helping to keep living wage jobs in our coastal communities. In this biennium, the initiative has helped create or retain more than 200 jobs in our industry. The initiative is helping our industry become more competitive and sustainable by helping create new products and services that will generate new markets for Oregon seafood and the people who produce it. Here is a snapshot of five projects the Community Seafood Initiative is working on with funding from the Oregon Innovation Council.
And Mr. Morrissey, may I just interrupt? I note that you've submitted some written testimony. We have that. So if you wouldn't mind just summarizing those, we can. I'm confident that the committee will read your full testimony. That'd be great.
Summarize each one of the initiatives. Thanks.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, there's five projects. One's the product development, where we've created new products, such as the retortable pouches for sardines. We're helping the Warm Springs Indian tribes develop a production facility, create new jobs. The second project is under the Market Links program, where we have consumers education for cooking school. That will increase the demand and retain jobs and make people familiar with how to handle fish. The third project is the Fishing Community Leadership. It's an initiative with Portland State University with food leadership to develop new leaders and help cultivate in the fishing industry. The fourth one is the Seafood Initiative to partner with the potential development of an interpretive center like a Tillamook Cheese Factory in Astoria, Oregon, that would help people become familiar with and trained on about the management and how the health of the resource. This will increase demand. The fifth project is a project called the Pacific Fish Tracks. This is a concept and tool that can help add value to the fishing industry by connecting the consumer to the information of the point of sale about where the fish comes from. We have a sample of the project here. You can actually scan.
You were getting some strange looks. Everybody's wondering where that sound back there.
Well, that we're currently having this demoed in two New Seasons markets, and you can take that particular package, scan it with a barcode, and it'll tell you who caught the fish, give you a picture of it, and give you a transparency of the food safety and chain of custody of how that product got from the ocean to your plate.
I did it this weekend. It's terrific.
It worked?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good. Expanding this project would include more species in the entire seafood producing industry, can increase the demand for Oregon seafood and create and retain more jobs. These are just a few of the collaborative projects that the Seafood Initiative is involved with. With continued funding, we plan to take these projects to the next level as we continue to work to increase the number of jobs created and retained for Oregon seafood industry and their communities.
Thank you very much. It's a great summary. Ms. Brown. Mm-hmm.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Chandra Brown. I am the Vice President of Oregon Ironworks. I am also a member of the Oregon Innovation Council, and I am on the Board of Directors of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust, which is OWET, which I'm here to talk about today. I will not be reading my testimony, so you don't have to worry about that. I'm happy to summarize. And I am here really about optimism and talking about the future, because that is absolutely what wave energy is all about. You may wonder why a manufacturer is up here. We've been around since 1944, and why are we looking at an emerging industry? It's because we know that what the future is about is innovation, and it's looking at the way we do things in our currently skilled workforce and figuring out how are we going to compete in the future and how are we going to take advantage of the various opportunities, such as federal funding, that are out there. So what we're really talking about with wave energy is such a unique opportunity. It's the creation of an industry. a brand new industry that right now Oregon, I'm very proud to say, is in the lead in the United States. We are it. This is the potential. I know Nancy Hamilton, she took a little of my thunder earlier because it was great when she was talking about the comparison with solar, but we often use the comparison with wind. What wind did for the country of Denmark with the hundreds of billions of dollars that wind energy does, that's potentially where the state of Oregon can be in the next 5, 10, 20 years. Yes, it's a long-term future. That's what the issue is with emerging industries versus the existing. But what we want to do is partner with existing industries as much as possible to move this forward. So as a few very brief examples of some of the things that Wave Energy has been doing, last year there was $8 million, which is obviously a very small amount when you're talking about federal dollars. Of that $2 million, so 25% of all the ocean energy dollars in the federal budget came to Oregon. In addition to that, you look at things like Oregon State University. OWET helped them with a $6.5 million appropriation, which is basically to be one of two in the United States, National Marine Renewable Energy Centers. So you already have an incredible partnership from existing industries. So going back again to the creation of an industry, you need legal help, you need service help, you need fabricators, the great steel and metal and iron workers, the shipbuilding industry that this state was built on plays a role in this. And then you keep going forward. You look at the fishing community. We're going to need boats. There's going to need to be operation and maintenance, the diving teams that already exist on the coast. It pretty much hits across the board all that you would want in terms of a variety of job creation. My cautionary note is, one, this is going to take some time, so it needs the investment now as we move forward. And two, it's I think it's something that a lot of people need to think big, I guess is what I like to say, because it really is the creation of an industry, and I think that's how it needs to be thought of. And again, the cautionary note would be, we're in a competitive market. Right now, Oregon has the lead position to lose. It's a great position to be in. We're first right now, but you've got a lot of other states, California, Florida, South Carolina, of other folks that are looking at this. And not only that, the international community is very involved. There's already Wave Energy devices off the coast of Portugal right now, generating electricity, putting it back into the grid there. There's a whole bunch of other projects all around the world, but I think Oregon is uniquely positioned. We have the best waves, we have the technology, we have the workforce, and we have the intellectual property and the university help to actually keep the lead and really grow this industry to where I think it should be in the next few years. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ms. Brown.
Happy to take any questions.
Any quick questions for this panel? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the optimism because this legislature kind of needs it right now.
Good.
And but my question, kind of springing off your optimism, is really for Mr. Clark and our other guest. I got so many up here, I'm so sorry. Is it Mr. Bornstein? And it has to do with food production. There are a lot of positive things going on, clearly, even under this cloud of fiscal restraint. Somebody mentioned that, you know, the federal government's, the new administration's interest in science is one positive on that science side. And I would agree with that, even though they might be possibly inept on geopolitical matters. But on the matter of food processing, I love the create more jobs. And what I want to ask you is this. In this area, is it more a matter in Oregon of the kind of creative things you're talking about, the innovation, the building capacity, international competition, than it is the increase in production at the agricultural level? In other words, we've got the food in the sea, in the field. We just need to create jobs immediately, so to speak. We need the kinds of things you're talking about in this bill. Is that fair, or do you want to elaborate on that?
In the seafood sector, we've been involved in the last 10 years of moving most of our product, big bulk of our product to China. It is now more looked upon in your carbon footprint closer to home. So we're trying to retool and do a lot of that manufacturing. In order to provide the wage jobs that here and to be competitive, we're going to have to innovate and we're going to have to get really technologically sound in order to produce the cost per unit of effort. So the answer in seafoods is yes, to bring it home.
From our standpoint, and in food processing in my area, being able to be competitive on a pound's throughput capacity and such is where we are able to compete in the global economy. So therefore, we talked earlier about having the workforce. Some prior work that I did on the Oregon Governor's Task Force on Education, and that being critical in having a skilled workforce that we can go to that can outproduce the rest of the world. That's the key. And so, yes, being productive and having a workforce that we can have here, then we can create those jobs.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our last panel, Scott Levengood and Brian Deckert, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Levengood. I'm the director of the Wood Innovation Center at Oregon State University, and I'm here today to represent the initiative to enhance innovation in Oregon's forest cluster. And I appreciate this opportunity to provide you with some brief background on the initiative and the benefits it'll provide to Oregon's economy. Because Oregon's forest industry is so closely linked, or so tightly linked, with new home construction and remodeling, this recession has particularly hard hit Oregon's forest cluster. And the industry is already facing very stiff challenges from other regions, not just nationally but abroad. We believe it's possible to make this industry more successful by making it more competitive and sustainable by focusing on how trees are grown, how they're harvested and transported, and also in by creating new products and processes and markets, ways of marketing the product. I'll give you just a few examples here. In the area of timber harvesting, we have Dr. Glenn Murphy at OSU's College of Forestry is working on ultrasound technology on timber harvesting machinery. And he's looking at this technology as a way to make sure that we have an industry that's as efficient as it can possibly be and have product performance where it needs to be. As it is now, logs are routed to mills based on primarily visual characteristics. But by using ultrasound mounted right on a timber harvesting piece of machinery, we could identify in real time the density of the wood and send high-density species and high-density products to structural applications and lower density to applications like you see here in the room, which are primarily non-structural, and obviously increase efficiencies there. That's in the area of timber harvesting. What we also need to focus on transportation as well. There are great opportunities to increase efficiencies through the use of technologies like global positioning systems. These technologies are in use now, but they need to be adapted for use in a forestry context for log trucks and for chip trucks and things like that, as well as for Oregon's mountainous terrain. By using these global positioning systems for fleet management, we could get a specific idea or exact location on where a truck was at any point in time and make obvious efficiencies there in scheduling fleets as well as in reduction in fuel consumption and greenhouse gas emissions, for example. Lastly here, I have some show and tell, too, in the area of new product, new process development. The samples I have with me here are a process developed by Dr. Fred Kampke in Wood Science and Engineering at OSU. Starting here with this one, this is hybrid poplar from the plantations along I-84 there near Boardman. Hybrid poplar untreated, it's a rapidly growing species, but as it is, it's a very low density, low strength product. Dr. Kampke has invented a process called viscoelastic thermal compressed wood, which we call VTC wood for short because it's easier. So by using heat and pressure, essentially you can collapse the wood cells and get a significant increase in density and strength with a rapidly renewable resource like this hybrid poplar. The application might be something like this here. It's a three-layer application that you have treated poplar on the face and back, very stiff and strong with untreated material in the center, and so you can get structural use like a beam or flooring out of something that started off with a non-structural product from the start. So the obvious question is, based on both those examples I just gave with the timber harvesting technology and with this densified wood process, What's the holdup in getting this applied and getting new companies and new jobs created? It's a pretty common situation here with any university-developed research, which are these specific examples, is that the professors and the scientists that are developing these new technologies have their hands full doing the research, guiding, mentoring graduate students, teaching courses, and extra capacity is needed to be able to do the commercialization side of market research, product costing, and things like that. And so that's the latter part of the initiative that we're proposing. So I'd just like to summarize and say that the Forest Initiative will help to ensure the long-term viability of one of Oregon's dominant employers. In fact, in 15 of Oregon's 36 counties, the forest sector represents half or more of the traded sector economy. It's a huge player in the state. By developing and commercializing innovations and inventions in this cluster, we'll ensure the long-term viability of existing firms as well as new firms and startups and new jobs, particularly in rural Oregon, but as well as in the urban centers as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I am Ryan Deckert, the president of the Oregon Business Association and the vice chair of Oregon Innovation Council. And, Mr. Chair, I saw today you have the Oregon Inc. package and you have Major League Soccer up. And so I have a lot of money riding on that I could get the people in the audience to go ole, 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 ole at
for Oregon Inc.
Or for Oregon Inc.
Okay.
So they participate. Lunch is on me.
A lot of talk.
Mr. Chair, I will be brief because you have heard and you've been a leader. And as your colleagues have, in putting this package forward, I think it's one of the great success stories for the state of Oregon. We made the initial investment in the depths of the last recession that hit this state, and I think watching Skip Rung, who was that first investment, Onami, it was an act of faith on the part of the legislature and the governor. It was faith that paid off, and as you looked at the examples that he exhibited in terms of companies and leverage, that is the really impressive success story that you have helped bring about to this point. And it is really, as I scan state government, I know of no other effort that you have this unique collaboration of the private sector, industry, universities, and the legislature and elected officials working together to future and further Oregon's economy. And so in that vein, we really do thank you for being a real leader. And as I've walk the halls this session, I will tell you the real encouraging sign I see in terms of optimism is that folks, it was a real battle getting this into elected officials' minds in the last decade, and as I look around the legislature now, that battle has been won, and we have more folks that really understand putting a little effort in and investment in, and what it leverages and brings in terms of private sector growth pays off, and so I think that's a victory for the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It's a great place to start. Any quick questions for this panel? I'm mindful of our time. We have another important bill before us, so we'll try to keep moving if there aren't any questions that are springing to anyone's mind. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Four people who have signed up to testify on this bill, we'll try to get each of them a chance to testify as well. Lenore Stevenson, so I'll call them in no particular order since we can try to be as efficient as possible. Robert Jordan and John Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And let me just say, given our time, I'd love it if you could summarize in 2 minutes, please.
We'll try.
Thanks.
I appreciate the opportunity to make some comments to the committee. I am Lynn Stevenson, Lenore Stevenson, and I'm CEO of DesignMedics. You heard us mentioned by Patricia Beckman as one of the companies they're working with. We're developing drugs to combat drug resistance in multiple infectious diseases. My background is doing bioscience startups, and I've done 10 of them. And so we are using the collaboration with Otrati to help us leverage the work that we're doing. At the moment, we have private investment in equity investment in the company, and that's leveraged by federal grants and a grant from ONAMI at 1.6 to 1. So we're moving forward. The Atradi work will help us both, has helped us in the past to bring in that funding, and of course the funding creates jobs, and also will help us in the future as we develop grant applications to access the federal funding that is building right now. And I think that's really all we can say. We're trying to grow a company in Oregon and create the high-paying jobs in the bioscience sector.
Thank you. You did an excellent job in only a minute and a half, and it really helps to hear direct experience. Thanks very much.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Robert Jordan. I represent SIGA Technologies. We are a Corvallis-based company that develops antiviral drugs, and I wanted to express my support for Atradi. I think Atradi represents an invaluable resource for the biosciences industry. I think it not only provides an infrastructure for leveraging the discoveries in the university systems, but it also serves as a nucleus for the biosciences industry, bringing together both the academic researchers and private sector scientists to develop drugs and create jobs and new companies within the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much. Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute. And I suppose when you're prepared to spend more than $20 million of someone else's money, you can attract a lot of very compelling stories about how to spend that money. And I do agree that all the witnesses before me have been compelling, and what they're doing sounds exciting. What has not been addressed is the question of opportunity cost. What might we have gotten if that money spent in the last years had been spent either by you and some other array of investments, or if it had stayed in the pockets of taxpayers to be spent in some way that they would have preferred? Now, we'll never know. And in fact, all of us face opportunity cost problems every minute of every day. We spend time on X, we don't spend it on Y and Z. The only way to bring that into balance, I think, is to internalize both the reward of something along with the risk. But when we stand to reward from something, but a lot of other people bear the risk, that sets up the problem. And sometimes it's best to illustrate that by going back in history with the benefit of hindsight to see something that's extremely obvious. And I'll just tell you a brief story and then get done with it. Going back, I was rereading recently a very entertaining history, the battle of the electric currents, that is the battle between Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla and George Westinghouse about how to electrify the world, AC versus DC. But before they got to that point, Edison was considered something of a crackpot in some circles. A prominent English electrician said with regard to his light bulb and his whole method of approach, "Neither Mr. Edison nor anyone else can override the laws of nature. The talk of cooking food by heat derived from electricity is absurd." Well, but such was Edison's reputation that the natural gas stocks plunged worldwide because Edison's vision was challenging the dominant paradigm of natural gas heating homes. And the British Parliament was very concerned about this because they had a lot of natural gas produced there. And so they tried to reassure investors by creating a special oversight committee of legislators to look into this. And their conclusion was that Edison's electricity fantasy might be, quote, good enough for our transatlantic friends, but are unworthy of the attention of practical or scientific men, unquote. Okay, so they missed that one by a little bit. Now, later, Edison then started criticizing Westinghouse and Tesla, saying they're all wrong, they don't understand this whole thing because they're promoting AC and he was promoting DC. And after a long battle, Edison actually was proven wrong. He lost the battle. Now, if there had been an Oregon Innovation Council at the time, or Chicago Innovation Council, or New York as it might be, what would they have done? Which horse would they have backed in this race? fortunately, they didn't have to do that because both Edison and Tesla, who were very, very compelling and smart people, all their backing was with private money. J.P. Morgan, a lot of other people. So it all worked out, but some people lost, some people won. It was all private money. So as you go forward, you can see a lot of cases where that was the case. Jimmy Carter thought the Synfuels Corporation would be a great idea. Okay, he lost a few billion dollars there. SST lost a few billion dollars there. So the problem really, to just finish up, is to say that if you really, actually there's sort of a yes-no decision. If you think that this idea, this model is great, and that state-run signature research centers can spend money better than people can, you should go in way more than $20 million. I mean, don't stop there. Go all the way. If you don't agree with that, if you think that people can make their own decisions and spend their own money more wisely and that you should stick to core functions of government that only government can do, then actually you should zero this out entirely and allow private investors to take all these risks and bear all the rewards.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Last word on this bill, Mary Phillips.
She's still here. Thank you.
As I mentioned to your predecessors, if we can do it in 2 minutes, we'd sure appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Reed, and the rest of the committee for inviting me to come and speak. My name is Mary Phillips. I am the Assistant Director for the Office of Technology Transfer at Oregon State University. And the signature research centers are very important to the operations of the university. I've been in tech transfer in Oregon for over 8 years, both at OHSU, now OSU. And I've seen the wonderful ability that the signature research centers, especially working with Skip Rung at Onami, and now with Patricia Beckman at Otradi, to really leverage the research that's going on at all the OUS and OHSU institutions to really actually pull the research together to make something start working and to come up with commercial products that we can actually license out and make a reality. So I'm actually asking you very much from the university sector to actually very much continue funding Oregon Inc. to the fullest amount you can. We have ways of putting industry together now and getting traction, and I think it will pay dividends down the road later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. Appreciate everyone's testimony today. We have obviously some very challenging economic times, but I'm optimistic, as Ms. Brown suggested, and I think we'll be returning to the question of Oregon Inc. before long, and hopefully sending this down to Ways and Means, where we hope it will receive the maximum funding that's possible. And at least I should say that for myself in the current economic climate. So, unless there are other comments on Oregon Inc., I will see none. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2720 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2531. Barbara, if you wouldn't mind giving us a quick summary.
HB 2531 expands the purpose of Major League Stadium Grant Fund to include financing, developing, constructing, and furnishing of a Major League Stadium designed for use by a Major League Soccer team, authorizes agreements granting incremental tax revenues for a stadium designed for Major League Soccer, prohibits transfer of revenues generated from members of soccer team to Major League Stadium Grant Fund until July 1, 2011, limits biennial expenditures of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for payment of grants to fund construction of a Major League Soccer stadium, takes effect on the 91st day following sine die.
Thank you very much. I invite Merritt Paulson forward, please.
Thank you.
And Greg Peden and Dave Barrows.
Quite well.
It's a party.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thanks very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm Greg Peden with Gallatin Public Affairs here representing the Paulson family and their efforts to bring Major League Soccer to Portland. Little known fact, both Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison are huge soccer fans. I'm sure if they were here, they'd want to endorse this bill.
Very nice segue.
I think Merritt's handed out written testimony to you, plus we've got that image over there to give you a sense of what we're talking about, the renovations of the stadium, and we also provided each of you a smaller version of that. So I'm going to turn it over to Merritt to introduce himself and talk about the vision, and then we'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you.
I see we kind of cleared the room here. Major League Soccer is not as interesting as the last bill. But,
perhaps not yet.
Not yet. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to quickly go through my testimony, and then we'll do Q&A, if that's okay.
And if you wouldn't mind just starting by identifying yourself for our record so
sure.
Everyone knows on the tape who you are.
Exactly. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Merritt Paulson. I'm the owner and operator of the Portland Timbers soccer team and the Portland Beavers baseball team. I'm here today to share a once-in-a-generation opportunity that will help build our economy and our community. This opportunity will create short and long-term jobs, showcase Oregon to the nation and the world, and generate the impetus for roughly 1 million Oregonians and visitors each year to come together, support our economy, and enjoy all that Portland and Oregon has to offer. Last year, we proposed bringing Major League Soccer to Portland and relocating the Portland Beavers to a new ballpark in Portland. This is a proposal made possible because of the growing popularity and success of the sport of soccer generally, and Major League Soccer in particular. Our ownership group is ready to invest $40 million to purchase an MLS team for Portland that would begin play in PG Park in 2011. Bringing MLS to Portland and PG Park requires finding and building a new home for the Portland Beavers because the improvements and modifications required by MLS to make PG Park a soccer-specific venue also make it impossible for baseball to continue to play there. At the same time, these improvements will make PG Park even more attractive venue for Portland State football and other community activities. Our proposal is rather straightforward. Invest roughly $35 million to improve PG Park for MLS, and then set our sights on building an intimate 7,000 to 9,000 seat ballpark in Portland for the Portland Beavers. The cost of the new ballpark is $40 to $50 million, depending on the location. Two locations have been the focus of discussion between us and the city: Lentz Park in southeast Portland and the Memorial Coliseum at the Rose Quarter. Regardless of the location, our goal is to see the Portland Beavers playing and financially successful in Portland for years to come, and building a new ballpark will not only help ensure the Beavers' future success, it will help revitalize and spur additional private investment in areas of Portland long overdue for renewal and reinvestment. No doubt, during these tough economic times, some will question spending on sports or new construction of stadium. These are fair concerns, but miss the larger issue of the short and long-term economic and community benefits that come from professional sports in high-quality civic gathering places. You do not have to be a sports fan to recognize that stadiums, like the performing arts centers, libraries, zoo, parks, and green spaces, all enrich the quality of life, economic, social, and cultural, that make Portland and Oregon so special. These are things that attracted me to Portland and the reason we have chosen to invest in Portland and make it our home. Like so many other visionary choices Portland and Oregon have made in the past, today, right now, we face another such transformational opportunity. Allow me to share what I believe are the five most important benefits of this project, and then I'll be happy to take whatever questions you might have. First, the opportunity to create 600-plus construction jobs and 300-plus permanent jobs associated with the soccer and baseball teams. Sometimes people forget that teams like the Timbers and Beavers are actually businesses that employ hundreds of people, directly and indirectly, beyond those you see on the field. This plan will add about 45 permanent jobs in baseball and 275 in soccer. That's in addition to the 600-plus jobs that will be created for the PG Park renovations and the construction of the new AAA ballpark. At a time when we need employment most, this proposal puts people back to work. Second, the opportunity to bring another major league sport to Portland, Major League Soccer, one that is positioned to flourish and that will cast an exceptionally positive national and international spotlight on Portland and Oregon. Right now, cities and private owners across North America are competing to bring the next MLS team to their community. Seattle, for example, has already sold over 20,000 season tickets, and those are full purchases, not just deposits, for its team that will begin playing next year. All of this because of the growing popularity of soccer as a sport and the financial strength of MLS. Indeed, we would not put $40 million of private capital at risk if we didn't believe MLS would succeed in Portland. Right now, the Timbers draw an average of over 8,000 fans to each game at PG Park. We project conservatively that an MLS team will draw over 15,000 fans to every game. That's because soccer has a strong and passionate following here, exemplified by the Timbers Army, some of whom members are with us here today, and by
by the more than 60,000 people, 60,000 children who participate in youth soccer programs in the Portland area this year, each year. Simply put, Soccer City USA deserves and will support soccer played at its highest level in North America. Third, the opportunity to create two multi-use facilities, facilities that are not only ensure the operational stability and success of their professional sports team tenants, but will economically enrich and improve their surrounding neighborhoods and city as a whole. The improvements to PG Park will have benefits beyond just MLS. Will make PG Park even more fan-friendly venue for Portland State University football, high school football, and other events, such as outdoor concerts that currently go to venues outside of Portland. And whether a new AAA ballpark is built in Lentz Park or the Memorial Coliseum, it will have a positive impact in attracting new private investment to those areas and will help revitalize either Southeast Portland or the Rose Quarter area. Fourth, the opportunity to attract MLS to Portland for far less money than other communities and cities are spending on sports and in a way that protects the taxpayers. We are currently in negotiations with the city on the exact nature of the financing package for PG Park and the AAA ballpark. But having said that, we do not plan to use city general funds for this project. Instead, we are looking at bonds paid by ticket taxes and user taxes for the use of those facilities, urban renewal funds in the areas around the facilities, and in the case of the soccer team, capturing a portion of the income taxes paid by those players. That is the legislation we are seeking from the legislature here today. And, of course, you know, those players would not be citizens earning income in Portland if we did not have MLS. We're not taking away from other programs. And fifth, the opportunity to create a positive economic impact beyond the jobs for our community and state. We estimate this proposal will generate about $50 million in associated economic activity. That's jobs and spending in small businesses, restaurants, hotels, and retail. More nearby people will come to MLS games in the new Beavers ballpark, and more faraway fans will come to Portland to enjoy the games. MLS will be a destination event and activity for people from across the state and region. And also, thanks to the national and international interest in television coverage for MLS, audiences across the nation and around the world will see postcard images of Portland and Oregon, and will further position our city and state as a destination for people looking for a place to either visit for a few days or live for their entire life. Finally, we are on an exceptionally tight timeline. Major League Soccer will announce two expansion franchises slated to begin play in 2011 by March 15th, actually March 19th. Five strong applicants, including our current USL rival Vancouver, are competing for these slots, and if we miss the opportunity this round, it is unlikely that Major League Soccer will ever come to Portland, given the league's goal of capping expansion and the trend of sharply escalating MLS franchise values. Our goal is to have a positive decision by the city in the next few days. We are working towards that goal as we speak, and then secure the support of the legislature and governor for the state piece of the financing puzzle. You should know that there's been over 6 months of public discussion of this idea, discussion we welcomed and have encouraged. The city of Portland established a citizen committee that has been meeting since December to review the proposal. Last week it was announced that, informally, they support the proposal 17-1 with a number of important conditions. In the end, this is an opportunity we are presenting for the city and the state and nothing more. It needs to be the right deal for the teams, the taxpayers, and the city and state for this to work, and that is how it should be. Thank you all for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. Would either of you gentlemen like to add anything, or should we get to questions?
Why don't you expand a bit on the financing, the nature of this financing, because I want to clarify the point I was making, that, again, this is not pulling away from any services. There's no opportunity cost associated with this package.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the financing structure that's set up in the bill is a little bit unusual. Some of you were here in 2003 when we passed the bill relating to Major League Baseball, but some of you were not. And this is sequestering the income taxation off of the players' salaries and creating a grant fund. It is then granting those taxes to the city of Portland. The city of Portland would then use city bonds that would be paid off by that revenue stream. This is not using state bonds. I think that is an important distinction here while you're looking at advances. And then the point that Merritt is making here is that what we are attempting to do is finance the stadium in a manner that is practical and reasonable on behalf of the taxpayers. And the arguments that we're making here is we're using the incremental taxes off of the players' salaries, that without the stadium renovation plan, we have no team. Without any team, we have no state income taxes, so that what we're proposing here was not, it's not a cut into the general fund, it's not taking away from any other government services.
Thank you, that's helpful. Mr. Barrows, anything from you?
No.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, for the record, having been to several Portland Timbers games, I had no idea the Timbers Army was capable of sitting quietly. didn't know that you had it in you. But I appreciate them being here. A couple of quick questions. So let me just make sure I'm understanding correctly. The only taxpayer dollars that are on the hook here are the taxpayer dollars that will be contributed from the players themselves if they happen to come here. Is that correct?
And the employees for the MLS.
It captures what is intended to be the executive level salaries of the team structure.
Great. And I'm just curious, are there examples, as we look at the success of sports in other cities, are there examples that spring to your mind of places and stadiums that have been particularly successful?
One thing that we presented to the task force was we had the mayors of Toronto, Salt Lake City, and Dallas write up testimonials. They publicly financed all of their respective cities' MLS venues and it basically testified about the economic impact and the positive community impact that those teams and those facilities have ultimately had on their cities. That's something that perhaps we could provide to you along those lines. I mean, it's bigger than MLS. There's examples across the board. You know, if you were to talk about from our neighbors to the north, whether the Mariners or the Seahawks or other professional sports. But, you know, those are three recent stadium developments, soccer-specific stadiums that have been put together, and they're probably more of an apples-to-apples type of comparison.
I just wanted to follow up quickly and let others ask questions, too. When you mentioned that it would be executive-level salaries and so on, I was just looking at the online tense as members of a professional athletic team. Are you suggesting that definition includes executives, not just athletes? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yes.
Okay, great. Representative Thatcher, do you have your hand up?
I do, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a couple of questions. What would be the average pay for members of this athletic team?
The total payroll for the team is in staff starts at about $3 million, and every 5 years that's going to go up about $2 million. That's the total payroll package that we'd be talking about.
Is that dictated by the league when you're?
It's a capped. You've got to, if you want to get technical, there's a David Beckham player exception rule. So, you know, we may well be going after
you're
an
bringing
exception
Beckham
player,
to Portland?
Not necessarily. Maybe we'll bring Zidane back. Sure. Don't quote me on that. But we certainly, we may well be employing that feature. But it is a hard cap, and that's one of the reasons the league's been successful. So whereas for this, you know, when it was an MLB proposal, you were talking about $150 million. You know, the number is obviously smaller here that we're talking about, but still very material in the context of our deal that, you know, is less than well under $100 million.
Barrows?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dave Barrows. Just want to point out that if, assuming Mr. Beckham returns from Italy permanently, plays for the Los Angeles franchise, when if he comes, hopefully every year, they play at PGE Park, his tax, the earnings on his income, the taxes on his income, inures to the benefit of this fund.
On a prorated basis.
On a prorated basis.
What they refer to at the tax foundation is the jock tax?
I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
As an example, A-Rod, who makes more money than anyone, has four CPAs that do nothing except figure out what taxes he owes to what entities. They have nothing to do with investment strategies or anything else. That's all they do, four CPAs. So it's a big deal, and for a Beckham, it would be a substantially greater amount than a normal MLS player.
These two are industries themselves, it sounds like.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Okay, based on 5 minutes ago, when we talked about a total payroll of around $3 million, we won't go. I'm just assuming it's $3 million, and so there's what, approximately $270,000 worth of income tax. If you take 9%, if I've done the math right, that would not be going into the general fund to maybe offset some of the impact that having such a stadium might have, like increased traffic, you know, state police.
They wouldn't be
if
here.
None of them have kids, I don't know, you know, schools, things like that. And I'm just wondering, so how do you explain that? If there's no impact, I mean, there is an impact, there's a trade-off to having a business, I guess. I mean, there are some costs, I guess, involved for the state.
I guess, Representative Fratcher, I might challenge you on that just because it's a chicken and egg thing. They're not here unless this happens to begin with. So, you know, it's not, you would never have that trade-off question without issuing, you know, this legislation that would enable them to be here to begin with. So it's not foregoing anything. You know, they're coming in, and you're talking about a lot of incremental benefits in terms of spending in the community, in jobs and everything that we talked about, forgetting about all the soft civic benefits, you know, that they will be bringing, you know, with the team here.
Okay, but then there's impacts that wouldn't have occurred had they not been here, too, and that's what I'm talking about.
I guess it's kind of a circular argument. Maybe I'm not getting where you're going with that, but I guess I understand. I don't necessarily agree, though.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think our argument is this, is by helping us finance the stadium through the mechanism that we're identified, the economic benefits of having the team, the economic analysis that we've done, the $30 million a year in economic impacts, is far outweighs, certainly over time, the $5 million initial investment that we're asking for here, and that is where the sort of the chicken and the egg dynamic comes. So without financing the stadium, we never see the economic impact of having the team, and so we never get a chance to recoup those losses. That's the argument that we're making.
I want to pick up real briefly on the overtime part of it. What's been the history? I'm not an expert on MLS by any stretch, but with little I've followed, there have been some teams that have moved, right? What's the history of that, and how does that work within the league? In other words, I wouldn't want us to make this sort of investment and then not realize the benefit that you're articulating.
We are being locked into a deal with the city where we will not be able to move the team.
Okay.
This is part of this.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the legislation addresses that timeline as well.
Okay.
Very
good.
I can't remember in a second, but I believe it's in it.
Representative Benson, then we'll come to Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. I think I mentioned that there, or I was thinking that you currently have a soccer team of some, or we have a soccer team of some sort in Portland. You'll forgive me, I don't know, not from being from Portland. And I assume that they're being paid some money now and they're paying income tax on that money. And is it my assumption correct that we would lose that, whatever amount that is, as a result of the new arrangement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, very good question. We do have a minor league team today. It's been in existence for a number of years. Players absolutely do pay state income taxes. What we are talking about is the incremental difference between what is paid today into the state general fund, just like the rest of our income taxes, and the income tax difference off of bringing a major league team, which would have a higher payroll. I don't have the difference, the increment, for you today. I can give you that the general annual payroll of the Timbers as it exists today is about $500,000 a year. And as we just mentioned, we're anticipating a payroll of about $3 million a year if we land an MLS team. So that'll give you an annual difference of what we're talking about. But I'm assuming once we, and if we move to revenue, we will have hard numbers on that from Paul Warner and his staff on the calculation on that.
And just a quick point of clarification on that as well. The $3 million is the starting point. This is all per the arrangement with the players' union. Those are five-year deals, and the guidance we've been given is those costs will go up around $2 million every 5 years.
Thank you. Thank you. Just make sure, I'm not sure I understood your answer.
Okay.
Why don't you give me a number that you think that maybe the current team is paying an income tax? To give me a guess.
Well, excuse me, Mr.
Payroll is $500,000.
Yeah. Representative Bence, $50,000 a year,
okay.
I guess.
And will we lose that as a result of this new arrangement?
No.
And why not?
Because we're talking about the incremental increase beyond that. That would stay in the state general fund. We are talking about the incremental benefit of having the team here.
In Representative Bence, I would just add there's also a stability issue. Well, you know, the league we're currently in is a terrific league, but, you know, the stability of Major League Soccer is a significant. We have teams leave and enter the league we're in right now on an annual basis. It's a high quality of soccer, but it's a big difference between Major League Soccer in terms of stability.
And that brings me nicely to the last question, and it has to do with how long you want this arrangement to go on. Is there an end? We hope that you're successful. We hope your team gets here. We hope it stays for a long time. At what point would this situation that you're suggesting end?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pence, in terms of the revenue stream from the state?
In terms of in terms of the funds that you're asking that we allocate to this bond payment,
right?
When the bonds are paid, does the money come back to the state?
Right. Okay. Representative, a couple different sections to that. One is that the what's anticipated in the bill right now is a 30-year sequence. If you extrapolate out over 30 years what the payroll and what the taxation would be to the state off of these player salaries, you get a number close to $22 million. What we are asking for is $5 million out of that 22. So, number one, while that streamline extends for that long period of time, what we're looking for is the initial $5 million to help finance the stadium in a timely manner. Once we hit that $5 million threshold in that grant fund, the remaining balance just goes right back to the state and is done.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Hawley?
I think Representative Benz just asked my question, the last one. I was curious when does the income basically quit going into this fund and right. start going to the state?
Right.
I think that was the question you just asked, and he answered.
Very good. So Representative Galicia had his hand up, and then come to you, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, I guess tangentially related, because it's the same subject, but very different questions. My first question is just, could you elaborate a little bit more on where you are in terms of the negotiations with the city, and if you have any projected end date? And then secondly, what do ticket prices run, and what do you anticipate? Just curious, what's the range of ticket prices, just out of curiosity?
Sure, Representative Galizio. I'll address the latter part of that question first. Current Major League Soccer ticket prices average about $22 a ticket. You know, we anticipate being right in the middle of the pack, right around the league average in terms of our forecast. And again, we're talking about start of play here in 2011. In terms of where we are with the city right now, we are going to be the task force meets tonight and will be issuing their formal recommendation next Tuesday. We're taking testimony tonight. It's our goal to have a resolution ready to go forward for approval with the city at the beginning of March.
And that's through the city council?
Yes.
I appreciate you used the word goal.
Excellent. Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I ask him when a ticket will cost you?
you almost threw me off there. In these budget times, I applaud you for the scheme, and I hope that you know you can make this work, because you can see the multiplier and you can see the success that some franchises have and the effect that has on a city. So, I want to encourage you, particularly for Portland. They won't do a lot. There'll be some baseball fans from my district, but they won't do a lot for my district. But I understand this. And I would say the baseball thing makes the most sense to me. I don't get the soccer thing. I mean, you don't use your hands. It's very strange. But here's my question, I think.
Good.
Oh.
You know, we do PG. Have a time limit, Representative. Should I start imposing a limit?
You're getting a yellow card.
I yield my time. I'm just curious on your plan. Why we redid PGE Park recently. Why new baseball? No, excuse me. Yeah, new baseball and soccer there versus the other way around.
Sure. Representative Gilliam, I guess it's really dictated by Major League Soccer. The changes required to make PG Park soccer specific involve putting stands on it along the, I don't know if you've been to PG Park, but along what is 18th Street there and would not allow for an outfield, hence no baseball play And so the idea being that, that getting sort of an intimate 7,000 to 9,000 seat ballpark in the Rose Quarter and in Lentz, you know, would be the solution there. But that was driven. If there's a way we could combine facilities, obviously that makes economic sense.
Is one quick follow up on that? Is the baseball, a new baseball stadium, part of the arrangement that would be entered into with the city? Or do they go one with the other?
Correct.
Okay.
And if it was Memorial Coliseum, would the Coliseum come down? That's the only way you could have room, I suppose.
It would. However, I would want to say for the record, we have in our plans to a considerable amount of money set aside to preserve a veterans memorial in the new venue and perhaps make it more visible than it currently is now at Memorial Coliseum. That's a facility that's costing the city $500,000 a year, and it is a pretty antiquated facility, but we understand the significance of the memorial, piece for the veterans.
Please.
Yeah, I'm not sure you do, because many of you know Franklin High School, where I graduated from, we actually took our commencement down there in 1971,
yeah.
And I graduated in that building. It's incredible. I'd hope there'd be a plaque or something.
We may have to.
On that note,
is it true story? It's,
I'm sure it is. Mostly. We have. I'm just looking up and down the dais here. Do you have another question, Representative Ward?
I just have one follow up to, not to Representative Gilliam, but to Representative Bent's question. I was wondering if you can point out in the bill to me where the time limit is for when the revenues stop going into the Major League Stadium grant fund and start going back to the state.
Representative Holt, I will do my best here in the next 2 minutes, and if I can't, I will follow up with you and find it in there.
Or you could show me later, too.
Maybe the thing to do, given our short time, is to finish that up. As if you find it before we adjourn, you could let us know, or we could do that offline.
That's
there are
fine.
A few other people who want to testify. I want to give them a chance. I know they've come some distance.
I just couldn't find it.
That's fine. Well, this is a very legitimate question, and we'll find the answer to that before we go forward.
Mr. Chair,
unless
just,
you just found
two things. One is, I think we had somebody from Nike signed up. They've submitted written testimony. They're not going to sign up. And then Duke Shepard was going to speak on behalf of the AFL-CIO and the building trades. Duke is in the hospital, which is the bad news. The good news is his wife's having a baby.
Oh. Very good.
This morning.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so Dan Bates is here, I think. I see him back there. If you'd like to come forward, that'd be great. Bill Perry, still here, very good. And Duke, we just talked about. There are also four people who have signed up. Given that we have one chair and then left and three more, maybe one of you can come forward now. Jeremy Wright. And then we'll try to catch the remaining three in our short remaining time. So please, go ahead.
Okay, for the record, Chair Reed, members of the committee, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association, who are here in support of the Major League Soccer proposal. I won't get into technicalities because most of you know I was not a math major in college. But we supported the baseball program, too. I think the one thing about this type of a program that is we just want to offer as food for thought is when you look at the lower, you look at the lower ticket prices that happen in this and baseball, it does invite a lot more family-type atmosphere, and you tend to see it at both baseball and these kind of events. People mingle around, go to restaurants. They do a lot more what I would call just walking around and shopping and eating than they do at some of the higher-priced professional sports or evening sports. So these tend to be a lot more for building community-based shopping and atmospheres than some of the other sports. So with that, I'll open up the wrath of Representative Gilliam now or later.
Later.
Okay.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, Dan Bates, Director of Government Relations for the City of Portland, and you've heard about the negotiations with the city, and we're in the height of those, and I wanted to come and indicate the city's support for this proposal. The negotiation, the financial plan, isn't completed, but this is a critical part of it, and as those negotiations go forward, iterate the city's support for this particular proposal.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Jeremy Wright. I am a Portland resident and a proud Timbers Army member here to give you guys a little bit of perspective that goes beyond just the dollars and cents of why this really makes a difference to us and why we're down here today. Other than Representative Bailey, how many folks have had a chance to attend a Portland Timbers game? All right, great. And so you know we're the kind of crazy folks in the North End singing and dancing and doing our thing, but it hasn't always been that way. When the Portland Timbers first came back to town, seven of us decided to what we want to do is create a more of European atmosphere and allow folks to express themselves at the game. And it started with seven lonely souls in the North End banging drums. But it's only gone up from there. We are now up to about 3,000 members. We've sold over 4,000 of these scarves. We've had the opportunity to travel the United States and even over to England. I was flown over there by supporters of Sunderland Football Club because they were so impressed with what we're able to do here in the Rose City in the United States. So this bill in the perspective of being able to bring MLS to Portland would only increase what we've been able to do at the USL level from a fan perspective. We would love the opportunity to jeer at David Beckham when he comes to town and give our various opinions to other players. But more on a serious note, we believe that, you know, right now we average about 1,500 to 2,000 fans in the North End on any given game day, 3,000 membership lists. We could see MLS actually doubling that. And that's the level of impact your action here today would take. And my three colleagues would speak to this as well.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? We have a very short time remaining. Thank you all for being here. Alan Schmitz, Scott Swearingen, John Grisham. You guys would like to give us a quick perspective, and feel free if you want to just say, I agree with so-and-so. That's fine, too.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for letting me speak really quickly in support of this amendment. I think professional sports are...
You could please identify yourself.
I'm sorry, my name is John Grisham.
Thanks.
Thank you. Professional sports are vital just as museums, parks, transportation, instilling pride in a community, our state, and our region. The Timbers have been growing in popularity, but it is time to take it to the next level. Bringing Major League Soccer to Oregon will raise our profile in the eyes of citizens of other cities such as Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, and Washington, D.C. We live in the second most populous region with only one Major League sports franchise. It is a certainty that Major League Soccer Club will be immensely popular and successful. If you go to St. Louis on the day of a Cardinals game, Green Bay, Wisconsin during football season, or Portland on a Blazers game night, you can find a game on at every local pub, and people are talking about the score. I've observed the beginnings of this phenomenon on summer evenings in Portland, and professional sports bring together lawyers, children, unemployed artists, and every facet of society to watch our team and express our pride in our community together. I remember walking after a game, running into a homeless person that said, "Did we win tonight?" And when I said, "We did," he smiled. I have no doubt that this will be successful, and if we can renovate PGE Park and land a Major League Soccer franchise, it will create jobs, spawn development, and become a point of pride for everyone in Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
For the record, Chair, my name is Scott Swearingen, Oregon State graduate and current University of Portland Master's Business student. I played soccer all my life. I grew up in Southern Oregon. I went to Hidden Valley High School. It's a small 3A, now 4A school. We won 4 state titles. It was a public school. That's women and men. And I just wanted to let you know that some of my fondest memories were driving up I-5 with my family and going to Blazers games at the Memorial Coliseum. And I can assure you that there's soccer being played in every rural community. It's Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon. And this will not just be the Portland Timbers. It will be a team for all of Oregon.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee, for allowing me to speak. I just want to point out a few things, a few benefits.
And you're Mr. Schmitz?
My name is Alan Schmitz.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out a few things that kind of have either been benefits, I guess. Renovation of PG Park will allow PSU, also the football team, to aspire to be a Division I football team. It will, you know, give them the capacity in the stadium to do that for when they choose to do that. I know 60,000 young kids in the Portland area play soccer right now and would love to be able to look up to a professional sports team in our area. And one other thing, it will also give us the opportunity to renew our rivalry with Seattle, seeing how they have gone to Major League Soccer, so we can keep our I-5 then coming down here and spending their money down here in Oregon. So, thank you.
Thank you. You had some good points. I appreciate you coming, and please don't make it your last visit to the legislature.
One thing I also wanted to say is Pele himself played his last game in PGE Park. So if we can foster that history, it should be a Major League Soccer stadium.
Ooh,
Pele's last game.
Wow. Even represented Gillian. Maybe that deserves a plaque. That's right. And there aren't any other comments for today. I've closed.
Is that the end of the? We have no one else. No lobbyists.
No other. Did you have a suggestion? Did you
want to
go?
Players.
Did you
want
to go?
Wait, nobody wanting a comeback. We had John Grisham came today. What do you want,
Mr. Chair? One final comment, Mr.
Miller.
Oh, there is
Representative
another.
Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say for the record that in my district, there's Portland Futsal, which is just about single-handedly reviving soccer in my district. And if the packed house is there every night or any indication, these guys are going to have a lot of company.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. Most of you know me as representing different business clients. Actually, I'm here today just representing myself in support of this particular bill. I think it's important. Portland's market is a prime market to attract Major League Soccer. I played soccer all my life, was fortunate enough to play Division I collegiate soccer and in a short stint professional soccer. And so I do know, and this is right before the MLS regrouped and started again, they are on the right path. And Portland is probably one of the, I would say, the top market. And I would urge the committee not to miss this opportunity because I think the benefits will outweigh some of the things that you are obviously debating here. And so, you know, I would encourage the committee to look at this and support this particular bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks very much. Representative Galizia.
Thanks for Sean. And I didn't know we had time, and we probably don't have time, so I would have asked the gentlemen who were up before the question, but maybe, Sean, you can answer. And so if you and Mr. Perry mentioned the families coming down, but when I think of soccer, I think of European soccer, mm-hmm. and I think of England, mm-hmm. and I think of the word hooligan. So could you just elucidate the fact that perhaps it's a different culture here in terms of what happens actually at the games,
yeah.
as opposed to what happens quite often in...
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, I've had the opportunity when I was younger to play across Europe, and I do follow a lot of the Premier League and La Liga and Serie A and Italy, and yeah, there is issues there. I think a lot of those issues are more long-standing when you read about the history of hooliganism, and a lot of that is kind of religious, cultural issues that have gone over time. In America, I don't think we have those kind of issues when you look at the history here. And I don't ever envision we've had those issues at Portland Timbers, at the stadium here. But again, I don't think we would have those issues here in the United States. And I would hope that we would gain some of the popularity like in Europe. And I guess we would, I think we can deal with those issues, but I don't think we'll have those issues. But if we can get the number of fans that are over in those countries that you mentioned, Representative, this would be highly successful. And I hopefully that day will come here.
Thanks. There's almost no one left. The diehards here.
Diehards,
real fans, right?
Three.
Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2531 and adjourn the committee. Thank you.
So, with enough time,
let's go. Okay. It feels like we just had a meeting with him like moments ago. That's fun.
More specifically to your office, you should have. Okay,
I should have lost one more.
One of the things that the city requires is a good effort.